Chilai, Chilai. The Life and Times of Mao Zedong. Presented by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and the Council of Ministers of Education, Canada.
The national anthem of the People's Republic of China is Chilai. It means arise.
Chairman Mao.
Last October, when I stood on the balcony of Tiananmen in Peking, I was unexpectedly taken aside by Premier Chou Enlai. He led me, together with my wife, to Chairman Mao Zedong. How does it look to you? I could not resist asking as I gestured at the adoring marchers. How does it feel? The chairman grimaced, shook his head, and said that it was better, but that he was not satisfied.
He's become more of a god. He's idolized by everybody. He's still there. He's still a symbol. So legends built up about him, and he's still there to lead them inspirationally. He's just a whole symbol of the communist movement in China.
Mao's first major move is to travel to Moscow, his first trip out of China. He finally meets Stalin, the man whose blundering almost lost the communists the revolution. A defense treaty is signed, and Russia gives China a loan of $300 million, but at the same time retains certain rights in Chinese border provinces. Within a year of the Moscow visit, China is involved in the Korean War. Chinese troops backing the North Koreans fight American troops for the first time. In the United Nations, she is condemned as an aggressor. China is treated like an international outlaw. Mao begins his controversial economic reforms. The peasants are unleashed against their former landlords and moneylenders. Many of the worst offenders were executed. Estimates of deaths run from several thousand to 800,000. Mao says the people must take their own land back, not have it handed to them by a new elite. Mao introduces mass collectivization of hundreds of millions of peasants. There are great problems, but none of the dislocation and killing that took place in Russia under Stalin. The next 10 years are even more controversial. Mao rushes industrialization, and the Russians provide equipment for 130 factories and send in 10,000 advisors. Mao inaugurates the Great Leap Forward, a massive production push. Much of it fails, but Mao says China can only learn from trial and error and has nothing to lose but her poverty. By 1959, 10 years after the revolution, the economy is stabilizing. Celebrations begin. At the end of September, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev arrives in Peking for the celebrations. He had recently visited President Dwight Eisenhower in Camp David, where both had worked out a philosophy of peaceful coexistence. At a banquet given in his honor, Khrushchev tells Mao that there must be peaceful coexistence between the socialist and the capitalist systems. Mao insisted this was a betrayal of socialism. An already straining relationship began to rapidly degenerate. Soon, border disputes between the two giants flare into actual fighting. The banks of the obscure Ussuri River become the scene of two antagonistic military camps facing each other. Jerome Chun.
The Chinese party from the 1930s onwards was developing along a different course from the Russian party. Their revolution was not a revolution for the masses. Their revolution was a revolution with the masses and by the masses.
I think Marxism is a basic theory at Maoism is the theory applied to a specific place, in this case, China.
Maurice Couve de Mourville, de Gaulle's foreign minister, And the man who met Mao during this period has a terse answer.
Well, the major difference results from the fact that one is 50 years older than the other. And that is essential.
An interesting suggestion. But Chinese communism is only 32 years older than Soviet communism. Edgar Snow sees nationalism as the stumbling block.
They are both finding it very difficult to apply Marxist theory, each to its particular set of conditions, in a uniform way, in a way that's comprehensible to the other, because their conditions are very different. Let's look at it this way. Russia and China both existed long before communism existed.
Jerome Chun argues that it was the Russians who changed.
Had Lenin continued to survive for 20 years after the Russian Revolution, then the position of these two giants in the political development of their respective countries would be even more comparable.
When I was in Peking this summer, Zhou Enlai told me this story.
Chester Ronning.
When Kosygin came to Peking to settle the border problem between China and the Soviet Union, Kosygin said that we cannot have the boundary in the middle of the channel, which is the international practice. It must be on the Chinese side, because the channel changes so often, we have to fix it on one side. And the logical side to fix it on is on the Chinese side. Mao Zedong said to him, "Mr. Kosygin, no, we will not accept it being on our side of the river. We insist upon the international practice. We're going to insist upon this. And if it takes us 15,000 years, we're not going to give up." Kosygin says, "But isn't 15,000 years an awful long time?" "Yes," said Mao Zedong, "it may be a long time. And if you think it's too long, I am prepared to whittle off 1,000 years.
With the Soviet advisors gone, China girds for a massive effort to industrialize, develop technology, and become self-sufficient. She moves quickly. October of 1964, at its Xinjiang test site, China detonates her first atom bomb. The message to the world is clear. Never again will China be dominated, dismembered, or bullied. But China protests that she will never become a superpower. She says she developed the nuclear bomb to prevent her being blackmailed by the nuclear powers, and that she will never be the first to use it. Paul Lin.
From the Chinese point of view, what is super about superpower, which they don't want to identify with, are five characteristics: aggression, intervention, subversion, control, and bullying.
Until that communist regime was installed in Beijing, China has been either occupied or humiliated by foreigners.
Maurice Couve de Merville.
So there is one thing that they want, and that is to be independent. Now that they have recovered their sovereignty, their entire sovereignty, they want to keep it. And everything is dominated by that.
It is 1966 and 1967. Foreign policy is not uppermost in Mao's mind. He had said for a long time that the revolution had only begun. Now he proved that he meant it.
Radio Peking.
Here are the main contents in today's newscast. In Guizhou Province, southwest China, the proletarian revolutionary rebels, guided by Chairman Mao's revolutionary line, rose in unity and took over on January 25th all powers from the Provincial Party Committee and People's Council and from the Guiyang Municipal Party Committee and People's Council. The Peking People's Daily military.
Mao's power was in decline. The country was being run by Liu Shaoqi, the head of state, who brought in economic reforms like those in the Soviet Union, including some restoration of private property and capitalism. Months of argument between himself and Liu Shaoqi culminated on the 25th of January, 1965, when Mao decided Liu had to go, and Liu decided Mao had to be put in his place. Mao now wanted a second revolution, a second stage of consciousness, but his power had declined. The Peking People's Daily refused to publish his article calling for a cultural revolution. The era of the wall poster arrived, as people posted their criticisms of the party and government on the walls of China's cities. One day, people found on the walls something no one had expected.
Bombard the headquarters. My big character poster by Mao Zedong. China's first Marxist-Leninist big character poster and the commentator's articles on it in People's Daily are indeed superbly written. Comrades, please read them again. Meanwhile, during the last 50 days or so, some leading comrades from the central down to the local levels have acted in a diametrically opposite way. Adopting the reactionary stand of the bourgeoisie, they have enforced a bourgeois dictatorship and struck down the surging movement of the great cultural revolution of the proletariat. How poisonous.
Millions of Red Guards attacked the structures of the party bureaucracy. James Endicott.
Liu Shaoqi stood for the line promoted in the first place by the Soviet advisors of the major emphasis on heavy industry and on central planning, and more or less leaving the agricultural situation to develop along the line of a semi-free enterprise. Liu Shaoqi was not in favor of the communes.
Former French Premier Edgar Faure.
It's in the entire area of the Cultural Revolution that Mao made his most original mark. On the cultural plane, Mao is the only really logical revolutionary who went all the way and tried to construct a form of true revolutionary culture and education. This is something the Russians haven't done. It is Mao who tried to transfer the revolutionary spirit into culture and education.
Gentlemen!
It is 1969, and at the Ninth Party Congress, Mao appears and speaks. He has crushed Liu Shaoqi's forces. China has set a new course, and he is totally triumphant.
I think he's sort of a way of life for a lot of them. He has so much to do with everything that they do. Like, I think that whatever they're doing during the day, whether they're working or playing, even in their free time, they sit around and discuss his quotations. Like, he's just so much a part of their life. I guess sort of like a god almost, a religion, you know?
Chairman Mao is being quoted freely, but people don't quote themselves. People don't really have the thoughts for themselves. If they've got a quote for every situation ever given to them. Chairman Mao says this.
Perhaps the most common attack made on Mao is that he has fostered a cult of personality, that Maoism is like a religion, and Mao a god. That the thoughts of Chairman Mao in the Little Red Book are recited like a catechism. that the adulation of the crowds is almost Hitlerian. Historian Hugh Trevor Roper.
Mao, like Stalin, has built up a personal power, what Khrushchev called a personality cult, a grotesque and nauseating campaign of personal adulation, which has given him a personal authority independent of and in rivalry with the established bureaucratic party.
Maurice Cuve de Mourville.
China is an enormous country, always difficult to keep united. And they've got to have the central authority present everywhere, even in the smallest village. In the past, it was the emperor, and now it is Mao.
General Jacques Guillermez.
If you are ideologically a giant, you have some sort of cult around your thought. This cult of personality is not so much the cult of the individuals, it's really the cult of a new system of thinking, of a new version of Marxism-Leninism. And if it is put concretely, the person of Mao Zedong, then it's far more accessible, more easy to understand.
Chester Running.
The Chinese communists felt that they needed a leader whose precepts would be accepted by all of the people of China. It is not necessarily a personality cult. It is not necessarily a worship of a new god.
Not a religion, rather a new system of thought. What is this thought? Paul Lin.
What Mao has brought to their minds, to a lot of people's minds, is the idea of breaking out of old strictures and using certain principles, certain basic principles for solving problems.
To understand Mao, not to accept or reject, but to understand his thought, the keystone of his philosophy must be seen. We can change man.
We're dealing on the level of the revolutionization of man himself. We're dealing on the level of an attempt to change human nature.
Harvard International Affairs expert Jerome Cohen.
Let me focus on perhaps to me the most intriguing contribution of Chairman Mao. That is his naive, romantic, hopeful, perhaps pathetic attempt to change the definition of human happiness in China. What he tried to do is to alter the lifestyle of 750 million people on the mainland.
Their life every day is trying to emulate Mao in whatever they do. You know, their work, whether it's a factory or in school or being at a performance, it is Mao.
Just in the way they live. They live according to what he believes. Like, I think even if he dies, like, there's just no canceling him out.
It's profound because it strikes at the very roots of human behavior. And it's an attempt to revamp the very fundamentals of man's relation to his fellow man.
He's ceased, I think, now to be a man and more of a philosophy, because you see a picture of Mao, but it could be a picture of Buddha, it could be a picture of anything. He's going to be like the Buddha. He's instilled the religion on earth, and now it's up to the people to carry on his thoughts.
I am a monk, roaming the world in the rain, with a leaky umbrella.
Chilai, Chilai, the life and times of Mao Zedong. Part 3, Chairman Mao, concludes the series, adapted by Edward Trapunsky from a prize-winning documentary produced by Mark Starowitz. Comments were by students of Downsview Secondary School following their recent visit to China.
coordinating producer, Lester Sugarman.